Welcome to the Marketing Commute, a podcast that explores the roads taken and the lessons learned for the best and brightest in marketing today. I'm Mike Boyd, and joining me on the commute this time are Andrew Baxter, Senior Advisor at KPMG Australia.
Hi, Mike.
Professor Vince Mitchell, Professor of Marketing at the University of Sydney Business School.
Hi, Mike.
In this episode of the Marketing Commute, we're joined by Jess Davey. Jess has had a highly successful career as an international marketing heavyweight, working in some of the largest marketing and ad agencies in Europe and Asia. Now based in Singapore, Jess Davey is currently the Chief Marketing Officer at McCann World Group Asia Pacific and is responsible for growth in the region. We're very much looking forward to hearing what's happening in Asia. We'll also get the latest thoughts and perspectives on the marketing trends with Mitchell's Marketing Minute. All right, let's go. Well, there's a lot going on in the world today. Gentlemen, what's caught our eye?
Well, what's caught my eye is all of this panic buying. Yeah. Despite everyone saying there's no supply shortages, and the voices of authority, you're saying there's no need to panic buy. People are still doing it. And what's interesting is what they're buying in different countries. So whether it's toilet paper, in other places like the US, it's guns of all things.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Well, the Dutch, it's cannabis.
no surprise there. but the interesting thing is it's the psychology of it all. Like in the US, they were saying that that usually there's a spike of buying guns between usually in the lead up to an election. Because, and particularly not so much a mid-presidency election, but when there's two new combatants, and usually it's because people are panicking about, well, what's going to happen to gun laws? I'd better stock up. But they're saying that the actual impact and even the Smith & Wesson share price has gone up. Like there's been an incredible flow-on effect of that's what happens culturally with the US buying more guns.
I also think the reverse has been the case, interestingly enough, and there was quite a fun one where one of the police forces over in the US put a little post out on Facebook saying that the latest batch of meth actually had the coronavirus in it.
That's outstanding. That's great.
almost went the other way.
So what does it say about what people care about then? So I can understand the Dutch and cannabis wanting to chill out, that is totally consistent, with an approach to life in a stressful situation. I'm not sure how much guns de-stress, a situation for you, but if that's about self-preservation, then maybe that's what the Americans care about.
So, what does it say about us?
Yeah,
buying loo roll. The rest hygiene. Of the world looks at us and go, what a bunch of lunatics.
Well, so toilet hygiene, is number one for Aussies and the Brits, right? Yeah, which, look, in a crisis, I'm thinking hygiene, given that we're supposed
short.
To. You don't want to be caught short. But also, we are supposed to be being more hygienic anyway.
True.
So if hygiene is the number one concern, that's probably a good preservation thing to be going into a crisis where hygiene's going to be beneficial.
I do also – the second category that the memes around toilet paper have tapped into has been alcohol. So we've seen a lot of memes around, the essentials being, five bottles of wine, a case of beer and four toilet rolls. And I don't know what that says about us either.
Our guest this episode of the Marketing Commute has had a hugely successful international marketing career, working in top agencies in Europe and in Asia Pacific. She's had an incredible marketing journey since leaving university in the late 90s, working for Ogilvy, for Nitro through Asia, and then most recently being appointed the CMO of McCann World Group for Asia Pacific in 2015. It's a great pleasure to have Jess Davey on the Marketing Commute.
Great. Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
So, Jess, from the very beginning of your career, you were working in the Asian market, first at Nitro and then at Ogilvy. What was it about Asia that drew you in?
A couple of things. So, firstly, in terms of my background, I'm actually third-generation Australian advertising. So my granddad and my dad both worked at Clemenger. My mother was a CD at Y&R and Leo Burnett. And so when I went into the industry quite late, I went in at 25, part of me wanted to get out of Australia and kind of build my own reputation. As we know, Australian advertising is extremely dynamic, but also potentially quite small. So I really wanted to kind of make my mark internationally. And Shanghai was a really dynamic place. I mean, I moved there in 2004 and it was still quite an evolving market. And I just loved the challenge of being able to go out there and kind of prove myself in a new and different space.
You talked about getting into the industry at 25, and a lot of our listeners, we have listeners from all ends of the spectrum, from graduates, some still studying, right through to some of the most senior marketers. What was that path between finishing uni, studying arts and literature and history? What was that journey? And obviously with the families, how did you get from there into advertising?
I'd love to tell you there's a silver bullet for a career path for me, but it's been a series of fortunate events, I think. I loved literature and history. I was going to be a lecturer. I had a complete belief in my role in academics and academia. And I fell into advertising largely, moving into kind of nitro semi by accident. And it wasn't a conscious choice. But what I would say is a lot of the skills that you get at university in general, regardless of your traditional career path, I think a lot of the skills I'd learned at university were really cross applicable. You know, the idea of research and constructing arguments and understanding data were all things that kind of translated really well. And obviously, having grown up in an advertising family, I think there was a bit of osmosis as well, which helped.
So, Jess, you said there before, I think you said you're in Shanghai in 2004. I mean, you must have seen so much of Asia certainly, change. But what would you say have been some of the main differences in consideration in terms of marketing and brand communications in Asia versus other parts of the world?
It's a great question. I think what's really interesting, I use an analogy a lot, which is like when I moved to China, a lot of people didn't have landlines, right? Because the telecommunications industry had essentially jumped straight to mobile phones, right? So a lot of people of my era, so I'm 44, so a lot of people of my age in China, they're entering into kind of mass communication was through mobile. And so their way of engaging with brands, with utility, is really different, right, than it is in the West, where we have a lot of legacy brands, we have legacy behaviors. And I see a lot of the brands that are successful in the West, if they don't, when they move into Asia, if they're not understanding that those markets are fundamentally different and the way they engage with brands is fundamentally different, that's when they don't win. Right? And we do see that. If you need to understand that relationships between people and brands in Asia is, I feel, a little bit more transactional than perhaps it is in the West. We have a lot of brand love in the West. We have a lot of iconic brands that we love. And I feel like that doesn't translate 100% into most markets in Asia. Brand love is not really a thing.
Yeah, and I guess that's one of those key things with, technologies like QR codes, which, didn't take off in, a lot of Western markets, but in Asia, particularly in China. I mean, QR codes is just the hook for almost any transaction of any type anywhere and has been for, going on a decade. So that's a really good indicator of that.
What's really interesting too is when you look at things like WeChat, right, which in China is this completely immersive, interactive mobile world, right, where everything – so when WeChat started, it was essentially WhatsApp, right? It was a messaging function. And it's so built into the everyday life of people in China, they don't even carry cash anymore. So the WeChat has now become a complete e-commerce payment system. All your bills are on your WeChat. Your identity lives on your phone. And it happens because, again, the relationship with mobile phones was built out of a very different need state than it is in a lot of Western markets. And even things like chatbots. Everyone discovered chatbots about 3 or 4 years ago in the West and kind of went, chatbots, amazing. When you look at how MSN Messenger used to function when I lived in Shanghai, MSN Messenger had complete chatbot-type interactions, right? So a lot of the technologies that kind of either took off in the West or have been rediscovered in the West, in some sense, have been living and acting in Asia, particularly markets like China, Korea, Japan, for a really long time.
You mentioned earlier some of those big brands and, the differences between the East and the West in how consumers interact, but there's normally some great stories about brands you've worked on. You've worked on some big ones like the Coca-Colas and Unilevers and Heineken's. Is there one of those accounts or one of those brands you've got a really fond story or a highlight around?
Oh, actually, a lot of brands. I think sometimes marketers and advertisers feel a little abashed about working in this industry. And I have to say, I've really liked most of the brands and most of the clients that I've worked with. I'd say a lot. I mean, I think I've worked on Dove for quite a few years. So obviously the campaign for Real Beauty. What I really liked about that particular platform was the way it was articulated in Asia when it was launched. It took a slightly different positioning, right? Because the beauty industry in Asia wasn't seen as so adversarial. You know, in the West, Dove had very much set itself up as critiquing the beauty category, right? There was a lot of talk about the no retouching and the role of Real Beauty. In Asia, we talked a lot about the empowerment of women, and it was a slightly different focus, which I really liked, that the brand was big enough and flexible enough to let us activate in Asia in its own way without force fitting like a Western lens. Another brand I'm very fond of is Coca-Cola, largely because I really enjoy working with marketers who love their brands, and there are very few marketers who are as loyal to their brand as Coke people are. They live and breathe their brands. I've worked on Coke basically my entire career at different agencies and in different iterations. But for a long time, you know, the number one product in China was Sprite. And they were really supportive of that it wasn't the Coke Red product that was the flagship that it was everywhere in the West. They were quite comfortable with the fact that Sprite was the number one product in China. And they supported that and let that happen. They didn't try to kind of artificially push it. So, yeah, I mean, I've worked on a lot of big brands. I'd say most brands these days are understanding that they have a role to play in society and for consumers, which, again, I think is a brilliant move forward for the industry, that the product is important, but also how the product is made, what the product's role is in people's lives is really important, and that you need to be good corporate citizens, which, again, from a marketing point of view, is a great space for us to be playing in.
Jessica, I'd like to ask you about mentors. We often need mentors to guide our careers. Who have been yours and how have they helped?
I've been very blessed. I've had a couple in my time. I'd say my boss for a long time, who is a lady called Sophie Hostetter, who I worked for at Ogilvy basically my whole career. I followed her. She hired me into the regional role in Hong Kong. I eventually moved to London and worked in her global team. I think it was really important for me as a woman to have a female mentor. I think there is a lens and a sensibility that comes from having someone that's coming from a similar space. And I think what was really important for me, what's really important to me about mentoring, and it's a lesson I learn as I try to mentor other people, is you shouldn't be making people in your own image. Right? Great mentors are the people that let you be your best self, right? They work out what your key skills are, what your values are, how to sell yourself. They give you the right advice at the right time to leverage who you are. And I think that's a really conscious thing that we need to do, is like, my path is not necessarily someone else's path. And I think mentoring is very much not just about saying there's only one route to success. I think one of the great things about this industry in general, and why it is still such an exciting place to come and play, is that we have a wide range of individual type capabilities, personality types, skill sets. You know, we're an industry of misfits and innovators and rogues. And I think that's a really important aspect of mentoring, is supporting people's individuality as much as guiding them through any type of, you know, corporate ladder.
So apart from giving them the confidence to be themselves, if you were giving advice to a young marketer wanting to drive their career in a global direction, what might you say?
I'd say, to be absolutely frank, I'd say you need to get onto a global stage. You need to be working across markets and understanding that, you know, your worldview needs to be broad and your curiosity needs to be broad. You know, Mike was mentioning earlier, you know, the coronavirus and the impact that's having on this region. You know, there is no one in my team who is not completely up to date with what is happening with the coronavirus, not just from a marketing point of view, but from like a social impact point of view, from a health point of view, because that kind of curiosity and making sure that you're understanding kind of all aspects of things is really important. So that's what I'd be saying to people. Don't come into this industry if you're not curious. if you're not interested in learning things, because this is like a perpetual change engine, this industry, more than anything else. So I think finding ways to expand your worldview and try to get some sort of global perspective, whether it's physical and geographical, or even if it's just making sure you're up to date online, that would be the first step. And that's what I look for in people when I'm hiring people.
Jess, are there any brands currently that you're admiring and you're sort of looking at and going, listen, you know, they're doing a really good job and with their message and with their overall tone, and who are they and why have they sort of caught your eye?
Oh, it's a good question. I mean, I'll give you an obvious one. Right, I'll give you an obvious one, which is obviously Nike, right? And everyone says Nike and we all go Nike, and of course, and they're an iconic brand. One of the reasons I really like it is when you look at, I'll give you a slightly controversial comparison. So when you look at that Copernic case study, when that campaign first launched, I think for the first 2 or 3 days, their stock price dropped an insane amount, right? Now, most other corporations would have potentially pulled the work or softened the work. And what Nike did was they found that perfect inflection point of the message that they had and the products that they were selling. And it's that the fact that the 50-year-old Republicans on Fox News who were setting fire to their Nikes, that's a pair of shoes they probably bought 10 years ago, right? Who Nike were talking to was the next generation, right? They were talking to the kids who are inundated with streetwear choices now, and they firmly positioned Nike as a brand that spoke to those people, and they held the course, right? If you were to compare that to, and I'm now about to be controversial, if you were to compare that to the Gillette work, so that film came out last year with the best a man should be,
yeah,
and it was hugely polarizing, and Gillette backpedaled quite quickly, and I understand why they did it because it's a business imperative. But I really feel like they should have stayed the course. I think that's a really important conversation. I think Gillette is uniquely positioned to be that brand because they built a lot of that perception of traditional, you know, sculptured masculinity. And that's really powerful. When a brand that built something comes out and says, okay, we need to rebuild it, that they have a unique type of authenticity. And I feel like it got shouted down. And I feel like they took a conscious step back from it. And for me, not working on P&G in full disclosure, and this is personally my personal opinion and not the opinion of McCann, obviously, but that to me is the sign. It's a brand that stays the course, right? You're not building a short-term brand. If you're a great marketer, you're not looking at 12 months. You're looking at 5 years.
It's funny. It's a bit like that sort of at the moment. It's that adversity of the marketplace. Okay, you know, you can see it now here in Australia. You know, coronavirus and just a bunch of other things. The summer we've had, the bushfires, the whole bit. There's just this economically. There's just this downturn. It's everything's a bit soft and everyone's being a bit conservative. Whereas the brands that have got that longer term focus are going right. Well, now's the time to do X when everyone else is doing Y. Or now's the time to be heaving all of our money into, we may not be doing into marketing, but what could we be doing in R&D that could be, you know, get us prepared for, you know, the future, whether it be 6 weeks, 6 months. But it's a time to actually go, actually, you know what, lean into this. Don't retract and pack up your camp and go home.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important that the perception of marketing, I think, is that, you know, at times we're seen as an overhead, you know, we're the first thing to get cut, right, is like A&P. The second that a brand or a product or a sales are in trouble. And actually what we are is we are an investment that directly hits their bottom line.
Yeah.
Right. And good marketing and good, like you said, good R&D, understanding supply, understanding the conversations that are happening. You know, the bushfires are a perfect example. You know, this is a nationwide crisis. There are brands who should be playing a role in this and enabling this and helping. And yes, it might take some money now, but aside from it being morally the right thing to do, from a business perspective, that's going to pay off long term.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more.
Hey, Jess, I wanted to ask you just about your day-to-day role, because normally most people working in agencies are working with marketing departments, and you have in the past, but obviously in this role, you're the CMO. What does a day look like or a week look like for you in your job now?
God bless. I mean, I don't know what my afternoon is going to look like. It's a combination of proactive and reactive, right? So it's an interesting question because a lot of people say to me, you know, coming from being a client lead, what is it like doing a CMO function? And I'm like, well, I've kind of now, I've got like 3,500 clients because my markets are my clients. The day-to-day of my role, I mean, I kind of see it as at the 30,000-foot level, it's providing the air cover and the infrastructure for our markets to be doing their best work, right? Which feels like a bit of a hashtag comment, but in the day-to-day, it's working with our teams to put together the right combinations of talents and skills for our clients. It's sitting down with our clients and going, sorry, perfect example, what's happening right now? You know, we're doing a lot of conversation around crisis comms and, you know, brand spends and where should money be going right now? And those are the kind of conversations that, you know, I have to have kind of on a day-to-day basis. Essentially, my function is growth. If you were to ask me to describe it in a word, the growth isn't necessarily new business. And in fact, I'd say new business is probably the least of my focus. I'd say it's more around things like organic growth, putting together suites of solutions, making sure our product is great, and also that everyone in the markets understands what we do and how we do it and why we do it, so that we can be doing the best possible work for our clients. That's pretty much a day.
Good day. Now, marketing's clearly changed a lot, and you mentioned you've got three generations of marketers and advertisers in your family. What do you reckon are the things that your grandfather would be sitting there going, yeah, that's still pretty much the same as how we used to do it? And then clearly, you know, the surprise of where we've gotten to now, you know, what do you think they'd be thinking of where marketing is today?
Oh goodness. I think my granddad would probably keel over when he looks at my workload. We're going through a bit of a bell curve at the moment in terms of the industry and its relationship with our clients. I think there was for a long time, we probably didn't value our creative product as strongly as we could have. So, you know, back in the glory days when, you know, Mad Men kind of era, where media was bundled into creatives, we were making our money off the media commission. And I don't think we trained our clients enough kind of historically that the creative product is what works. It's what matters, right? And so when in their infinite wisdom, the powers that be decided from like a holding company and a network point of view, that decoupling media from creative was going to give you two slices of the pie. What really happened was the creative was devalued because all of a sudden we're trying to discuss with our clients the legitimate value of creative when they're used to spending X amount of money and getting both, right? And I think off the back of that for a long time, that a lot of times the relationship is almost adversarial, right? With clients, it's a perpetual conversation for us to justify the value of what we do, right? Why things matter, why we need to have strategy, why we need to have like long-term brand platforms and not this immediacy of, you know, stack them high, sell them cheap, right? And I think you can see that in some of the IPA studies around, you know, like the effectiveness of campaigns is tailing off now because they're shorter. And people aren't investing in long-term brand platforms and equity. So I think to me, the big shift, and my parents would be the first to tell you, because every time I go home for Christmas, they're legitimately horrified at the amount of time I spend on my phone and email. Because again, back in those days, you didn't have the immediacy of an email from a client, right? That was a fax. I can remember being little and being in the Whitsundays for a holiday, and they had to send a helicopter to come get my dad to go to a meeting, right? Like it was a built-in kind of space and time gap between yourselves and your clients. And I think now a huge part of what we sell our clients is we're always on, right? It's 24/7. My clients call me anytime and I answer the phone anytime. So I think, you know, if I sat down with my granddad and said, congratulations, welcome to the 23-hour job, bless his heart, rest in peace, he would probably keel over.
At least he wouldn't turn around and say, well, what are you doing for the other hour?
Yeah, well, there'd be that.
It's funny that we have lived through, I mean, with the exception of our producer, young Billy, we've all lived through that a time that was, we can remember when you would switch off and you'd go home at night, and then, you know, the mobile device was something of, you know, Jetsons. It was make believe. It was something that was just, we just couldn't even fathom. And we've lived through that whole and had that whole change in our working careers. And, you know, for better or worse, it is a challenge for us, and it is a struggle to understand how it balances our lives.
Absolutely. I mean, I was at a great talk. Alain de Botton came to Cannes about 5 years ago, and he gave a great talk where he said, you know, I've been walking up and down the Croisette, and I've been talking to, you know, marketing and industry professionals, and this phrase keeps coming up, which is work-life balance. And he said, and I feel like you're engaged, you know, as an industry, you've engaged in this incredibly false dichotomy, which is there is no such thing as work-life balance. There's life.
Mm.
Right? And inside life is work, but also family and personal life and hobbies and passions and interests. And he said, but the fact that, and I don't think it's exclusive to our industry, but the fact that we've now all trained ourselves to think about work and life like they're two equal pillars is actually kind of a pretty toxic way of framing the conversation.
Looking into the future, what does the road ahead look like for Jess Davey?
The thing I love about my current role, aside from the fact that I'm a huge fan of McCann and actually their positioning in the world and what they stand for, and I'm a true blue McCanner, I'm super happy in this role, and it evolves, right? So this is the nature of being a CMO, and I think it's the nature of being a client handler right now, is the roles are evolving. At some point I want to come home, you know, Melbourne somehow became the second most livable city after Vienna, which I feel was deeply wrong in terms of the polls. But I mean, Melbourne is still one of the greatest cities in the world, North End specifically. And absolutely, I want to go home at some point, not right now. I love Asia. I love being able to travel around Asia. But down the road, I'd like to come back, settle into Melbourne with my cat. But in terms of career, I've never been a kind of huge plan forwarder. I go where I want to go. I go where I think the work is interesting and where the opportunity for me to do something interesting. So I'll see what happens next.
Fantastic. So just one last question. How do you commute to work?
I get the bus. So Singapore public transport is a miracle, right? There was a great article a couple of years ago in the Straits Times, and it was a headline that said something like, is Singapore the most spoiled country on earth? Because the air conditioning broke in one carriage on one train, and it was broken for about 5 minutes. And an irate commuter tweeted at the Ministry of Transport and said, I have been in this booth and the air conditioning's not working and it's been down for 5 minutes. And the Ministry of Transport apologized, took the carriage offline and fixed it. Singapore is the world's most organized, logical city. And because I travel so much, I'm on a plane so much, I feel like I'm kind of killing the Amazon. So the least I can do is kind of public transport where I can.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, Singapore's a great town, and yes, the public transport up there is fantastic. The reason I ask that is, what's on your iPhone? What are you listening to? What's your favourite song?
It's a commuting song.
For your commute.
My all-time, well, okay, there's two. First one is Under Pressure. So Bowie
nice.
And Queen.
Yes, well done.
When I took my first big regional role in Hong Kong, I have to admit, grappling with a certain amount of imposter syndrome, plus in the spirit of frankness, I was somewhat underqualified for the job that I got. That song was the exact distance of the walk from my service department to the office, and it was like 3.5 minutes. And so as I hit the doors of the agency, I was kind of amped up and buoyed and ready to go. So that one is a constant go-to. The second one is Good As Hell by Lizzo, because she's iconic. And I think she's very much a manifestation of the changes we're seeing in culture. You know, she's unapologetically beautiful. She's proud. She's a plus-size woman. She's out there living this really interesting evolution of self-love. And it's just a banger of a song. So that's on my constant morning commute playlist.
Fantastic. Well done. We love that. All right, Jess, look, thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely fantastic having a chat with you. And we as I said, we really appreciate you taking 45 minutes out of your very busy day to chat with us here on the Marketing Commute.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So for this week's Marketing Commute, yeah, I've taken something from the Harvard Business Review. Yeah, called the era of antisocial social media. Social platforms are still reporting robust growth, but a key demographic appears to be somewhat in retreat. Surprisingly, young people. For example, 2019 social media usage among Americans aged 12 to 34 has either leveled off or is waning. Some explanations are that after years spent constructing carefully curated online identities and accumulating heaps of online friends, they want to be themselves a bit more, yeah, and make real friends. Apparently, they're also craving a bit more privacy, safety, yeah, and respite. However, this poses a problem, yeah, for marketers. And one solution, yeah, for them is to create closed and often more private and interactive online spaces called digital campfires. These, yeah, are centered around shared interests, using private messaging, micro-communities, and shared experiences. So private messaging campfires are usually, but not always, yeah, with one's real-life friends. Apparently, nearly two-thirds of under-30s in one survey said they prefer to talk in private message threads rather than in open forums. And this is partly because, yeah, they can share things more openly. Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp are amongst the most well-known examples of these. The other tool is micro-community campfires, which are primarily interactive, private or semi-private forums where people gather around interests, beliefs or passions. Facebook groups are probably the best known example, or the close friends feature within Instagram stories. Finally, shared experience campfires, yet are private or public forums, where people can participate in shared experience. An example is Fortnite. This is a multiplayer video game that has more than 200 million users, and up to 8 million of them are online at any given time. And half of the teens, yeah, that say they use this say they do so to keep up with their friends. These phenomena echo Mark Zuckerberg's March 2019 public post announcing a strategic shift towards more closed, private modes of communication. Not only because, yeah, the data shows that Facebook is losing young audiences, but also because 98% around about of Facebook's revenue comes from advertising, and people in smaller, more closed forums are much harder for advertisers to reach at scale. So things are getting interesting, but a lot trickier for marketers. Any thoughts?
I think the challenge there is, A, that's a very, very broad age in that study, 12 to 34, like that's an eternity. I watch my children, you know, the way that they use social media, I mean, it's totally that around using the platforms, not for the, hey, look at me to the wide world, it's small groups, you know, customized messaging between their mates based on shared interests of whether it's sport or school or whatever it is. I mean, it's absolutely the way to go, and it will be a real struggle for brands to find their way in there.
The other thing that it reminded me of was, you know, I think kids at a very young age now have this dilemma of what their personal brand may or not may be. You know, what do they want to make public? What don't they want to make public? You know, the peer pressure around that. You know, and I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine when our kids were born many years ago, and I was grabbing their Twitter handles and Facebook handles to make sure that they had them. And he was like, you can't do that. They've got to create their own identity. You shouldn't be doing that. So there is this sort of thing about, you know, as people pull back and, you know, unwind what these very carefully managed brands have been, or often you'll see with kids, they have two. They might have something that's a lot, you know, two different handles, one which is more the public view and something that's behind being probably their real self with their friends.
The idea that was around, you know, for a while, that privacy is dead and that, you know, every millennial, you know, believes that, you know, clearly kind of isn't true. And what I think is quite interesting is that just as, you know, in the offline world, you know, where we have people who we trust and we want to divulge, you know, certain, you know, things, in the online world now, we're seeing that being reflected, you know, in these smaller, you know, online kind of spaces. I get that, and it's great, you know, to see, you know, the needs that we have face to face are being accommodated, yeah, by, yeah, the online world. I guess my problem is still, that Facebook still owns that data. If they become customer privacy champions, that Facebook has often not been perceived as being. There's a space here for brands to own that trust, so that people do feel comfortable in those small intimate spaces and are willing to give it up.
Well, that's it for this episode of The Marketing Commute. Thanks to our guest, Jess Davey from McCann World Group Asia Pacific, to Andrew Baxter from KPMG, and to Professor Vince Mitchell from the University of Sydney. Our producers, Boyd Britton and Billy Gleason, to the studios here at the University of Sydney Business School, and to KPMG's customer brand and marketing advisory team. You can find The Marketing Commute on all good podcast networks, and you can read more detailed show notes and get links from each episode and find out more about our guests and presenters at our website, themarketingcommute.com. I'm Mike Boyd. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the next stop on The Marketing Commute.
You have reached your destination.